Welcome to 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. I'm Michael Colville Anderson. Welcome to my happy place, my podcast where I self-medicate against my constant overthinking and anxiety about my own mortality with tiny happy pills of positivity and reflection. Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead podcast. You know, one thing I'm certainly not going to miss when I'm dead is global pandemics. It won't make this list, but I could, however, miss living in Denmark for being one of the countries in the world that has tackled the pandemic best. But you know what? This is going to be the one and only COVID-19 episode. Because, ironically, a few days after my third vaccination, I went and contracted that virus that we've all been hearing a whole bunch about. I have it right this very minute as I isolate myself in my home. Luckily, I have exactly zero symptoms. Literally zero. I'm just going about my daily routine without leaving the apartment and counting the days until my 7-day isolation is done. 3 days left. So, let's get stuck into a new episode. And remember, kids, please give it a star-studded rating on iTunes, and I've heard that Spotify now has a rating system as well. So if you don't mind helping out, a good rating there, if you are so inclined, would be cool. So let's do it. Episode 15 is in the house. Number 60. Archaeology. There are two primary pushes I get on my smartphone regarding news. One is Premier League football, and the other is archaeology. For most of my life, archaeology has been a primary interest to me. I devoured books about it as a kid and teenager. The whole fascination of uncovering secrets from ancient times. Imagine the mind-blowing amazement when the Indiana Jones films came out. And I sat there in the cinema, watching archaeology and adventure all wrapped into one. My fantasy play as a kid was rarely things like outer space or role-playing games like Dungeons and Dragons and all that. Mine was always based in reality and history. Growing up on the prairies, I lived in constant hope that I would find an arrowhead from a First Nations hunter or warrior. Unfortunately, that never happened. I did find a large part of a bison jaw once, with a row of teeth. I didn't consider for a moment that the bison died of natural causes. Oh, no. My imagination was not in doubt. It had been hunted by members of the proud Blackfoot Confederacy, now known as the Niitsitapi First Nation, and the meat fed the people, and the hide was made into clothing to protect them from the harsh winter. Maybe there was a young boy like me in the hunting party, and it was his first hunt, and he took aim with his bow and arrow, wanting to prove himself to the others. I could spend an entire day imagining the whole event and populating it with characters. The wildest thing I ever found was far from home. One of the strangest things I did as a young teen was signing up for a religious organization that sends teams of people around the world to help developing nations. Teen Missions International, it was called. I didn't care much about the whole zealous religious angle, and now, as an atheist looking back, it was kind of a goofy thing to do. But I didn't care. I was 13, and I went first to Florida, and then the Philippines, without my parents, for a long summer. How cool was that? We were tasked with building a house for some Bible college on the island of Cebu. One day, we were clearing rocks the size of cantaloupes from the building site and throwing them into a pile. When one rock landed, it suddenly split evenly into two, and I was amazed. Right there, in the middle of one of the halves, was a hole, and in it was a seashell. I could just reach down and pick it out. My mind was spinning. I mean, come on, it was a rock. Rocks are millions of years old. And inside the rock was a seashell in perfect condition. It was in a kind of an air bubble in the rock. What happened here? Was it lava that engulfed a creature in the shell that wriggled about in desperation, only to have the rock cool and solidify around it, creating a circular tomb? I am just as excited right now as I was at 13. And, of course, frustrated at not knowing the true story. Sure, this is not archaeology. This is natural history, I know. But I'm looking at that shell right now at my desk. 40 years later, literally the most exciting discovery in my life. I guess a close second would be the old garbage dump on a West Coast island that I spent summers at in my childhood. My sister's house was on the spot of the biggest hotel on the island back in the late 1800s and early 1900s. They just wandered into the woods to dump their garbage back then. The only thing that remained when I found it was glass bottles, and many of them had paper labels that were still intact. I gathered them up and cleaned them off. I ended up making a couple of $100 selling them to a collector in the city. But after I had learned all about how to date glass bottles based on the way they were designed, the desire for the thrill of discovery has not waned in me at all. Back in the lockdowns of 2020, I was this close to buying a metal detector, strapping on my boots, and heading out into the fields of Denmark in search of gold. It is an El Dorado out there, and the number of metal detector enthusiasts has exploded over the past few years. There is a massive backlog in Danish museums because so many people are finding so many damn things in the soil. Gold, silver, coins, jewelry, weapons, you name it. From millennia of human habitation through the different ages, stone, iron, bronze, and, of course, into the Viking era. There is a balance to this in my mind. There is the romanticism of wandering diligently through foggy fields and registering, all of a sudden, a loud beep. Kneeling down and digging out a treasure from ancient times. Did someone drop it? Was it an offering to the gods? Was it buried for safekeeping ahead of an attack, and nobody came back for it? Am I related to the person who left it there, or who crafted it? Oh, so many questions. Then, on the other side of the equation, is the fact that I think it's all a little bit dorky. Being a metal detectorist, it would be a hobby. And, for various reasons, I've never really wanted to have hobbies in my life. But then again, I just heard a podcast and I'm now reading the book it was based on, The Baltic Origin of Homer's Epic Tales. Basically, 3,000 years ago, people emigrated from Denmark to Greece because of climate change, and they brought their stories with them. These tales ended up getting embedded in the Greek region, and then a guy we know, Homer, started writing them down. The Odyssey and the Iliad that we all learned about in school. For a couple thousand years, nobody could figure out the geography of Homer's stories. None of it made sense on a map. Homer had specific descriptions of places, but nothing in the Mediterranean matches. Ithaca, Troy, and all that. But one Italian academic realized that all the places match perfectly if you superimpose them onto the Baltic and the Northern Atlantic. And many of the place names match as well. Now I want to get a damn metal detector and go to Toja in Finland, which is where Troy actually was, or the Lofoten Islands, or the Faroe Islands, or the Danish island of Lule, which was Ithaca, to find the archaeological proof, to uncover secrets lost for thousands of years. Then there's the news from last month that the Vikings were probably the first people to discover the Azores, thanks to DNA analyses of the mice on the island, which originate in Scandinavia. I would love to be a part of a team that finds whatever settlement they might have built. Rapid advances in technology are making archaeology even more exciting. LiDAR and satellite imagery are changing the game completely. We're finding stuff that was right under our noses all along. A few years ago, there was a summer drought in Denmark. The landscape was parched. Some archaeologists were flying over the country taking photos in a search for lost buildings, settlements, and towns. The drought was bad for many, but perfect, it turned out, for these archaeologists. For example, in the middle of a brown, dried-up field, they noticed a row of small green circles. It turns out it was wooden logs that originally formed the wall of a longhouse. The wood retained moisture due to its depth, so grass grew on the surface in small circles in a wasteland of dried-up fields. Now, I don't know these people, but I can imagine their thrill upon discovering this and then manically going through all their previous photos for similar clues. Apparently, the funding for their project was about to run out when this happened. The long list of historical sites they discovered hopefully led to an extension of their funding. Then there's Sarah Parkak, an American archaeologist who pioneered the use of satellite imagery to find hidden secrets beneath the sand and soil. She launched Global Explorer, a website where she crowdsourced archaeology. I have spent loads of time looking at images from Peru, trying to identify locations of ruins together with thousands of people from around the world. Brilliant concept. And I really want to drink with her one day. If you could discover something, what would it be? Personally, I fancy the idea of hacking my way through a jungle with a machete to find an ancient city. But that is probably my inner Indiana Jones talking. I would most likely be spotted somewhere in the region around Newfoundland or eastern Canada, finding a new Viking settlement. There's looking for archaeology, and then there is planning it. When I was a kid, I'm guessing about 9 or 10 years old, I decided to make some humans in the distant future thrilled and fascinated. I made a time capsule. I used a hard, clear plastic box the size of 2 decks of playing cards. I filled it with a letter to the future, a photo of myself, some coins, some hockey cards. The latter two being valuable to a boy, so you can see my level of commitment here, right? I sealed it up with tape. I found an auger in the garage, the tool you use to make holes for fence posts. I found a spot in the vegetable garden, and I dug. I ended up with a hole about 30 centimeters wide and 1.5 meters deep. I dropped in the time capsule and covered it up. Back in 2006, I was visiting my childhood home, and then I suddenly remembered that time capsule. It was summer, and I decided to dig for it. I could only roughly remember the location. I ended up with a massive hole, 1.5 meters by 2 meters and 1.5 meters deep. But no damn time capsule. Simply couldn't find it. So I reverted to the original concept, imagining some humans in the distant future, finding it, reading my letter, seeing my photo staring back at them, making them wonder how the hell that time capsule got there and when it is from. I remember my mom saying at some point that she wished I would become an archaeologist. She never pushed me to be anything, but she harbored a secret desire to be one, and I guess a regret that she never did it. I have no plans to become one, but I am currently working on a project that will be as close as I ever get. I'm writing a new TV series for me to host called Urban Origins. The plan is to visit a long line of original cities on every continent and to look for patterns in urban design between cultures that didn't even know each other existed. How did they design roads in the Aztec, Inca, Mesopotamian cities? What was the average size of homes around the world through 7,000 years of urban existence? What ideas and solutions are long forgotten but can be applied to the pressing issues of urbanization and climate change? Every society in history has been fascinated by the technology that is right in front of them, and the promise of what's to come. We forget to look backwards, over our shoulder, at things that once worked well in the long history of cities. Archaeology can be a source of not only fascination and imagination, but of learning. Number 61. That place where the river bends. On the maps of each of our lives, there are places marked with a red circle. Places that mean something. There are different kinds of places that you and I will consider memorable for a long list of reasons and for integral moments that happen there. Here, I'm talking about a place. A place that is special to me. The place is the thing, not things that happen there. Do you have one of these, or more, in your life? This place is one that I frequented in my childhood. I associate it with dreaming, thinking, and with freedom. When I think about it, it feels like I spent a great deal of time there. But I probably didn't. I went often, but it might only be 20 or 30 times. This does little to diminish my romanticizing of the place, or the pedestal on which I've placed it in my memory. It is a riverbank. Cold mountain water rushes down through an unforgiving landscape from its source. From an alpine region through subalpine, boreal foothills, and aspen parkland. The river is 120 kilometers long, but here, right here, at this spot, it bends. A wide bend, cutting into the cliff on the far side. It calms down, smooths out. The surface is almost glass-like, despite the current and its rugged, mountainous origins. On my spot, the southern riverbank is wide, with smooth, light gray rocks. Many of them are perfect for skipping, and that was a primary activity for me when I spent time there alone. A couple of kilometers further on, the river flows into a large reservoir. 10 kilometers past the concrete dam, it merges into another, larger river and continues on its way to a northern sea. I remember it as a quiet place. The wind whistling through leaves and pine needles. Birdsong. That's about it. I don't know if I ever took anyone there. I think I might have, but that would have been an exception to the rule. For this was a secret place for me in that period of time between late boyhood and getting a car and doing late teenage things. If I did bring a friend or a girl there on occasion, I really hope that they've forgotten all about it. I rode my bike to get there. I can still remember the route in great detail. I just Googled it and was surprised to discover that it took about 40 minutes. That is way longer than I expected. I had to navigate sidewalks along busy streets until I got to the reservoir and followed the path that circles it. But at the far end, where the river flows into it, I veered off onto a rough path through the woods. I had to park my bike near the bridge and continue on foot to get to the place. I saw other people there once in a while, but very rarely. People would run, walk, and cycle on the reservoir path, but few made it as far as this riverbank. I remember looking at a map back then and realizing that at some point on the last leg through the woods, I left the city limits. That was cool. In the woods nearby, I discovered trenches and foxholes, which baffled me. A trip to the library taught me that the army trained young men for the First World War right there in those woods. Trenches dug to resemble the hell that would face them in Belgium and France. I spent hours in those overgrown trenches looking for bullet casings or any remnants of that time. In vain. But it was all about the riverbank. I would skip rocks, throw logs into the water and follow their trajectory, go for swims in the summer and dry off on the uncomfortable stones as I stared up at slowly circling hawks. Not a lot of action, but it was exactly what I needed. I took a cigar box with me one day and dug a hole among the roots of a tree overlooking the river. I can't remember what I put in it. I do know that I forgot where I buried it. All the trees looked alike. The river has flooded a couple of times since then, so I'm sure it's long gone. I have one photo of this place where the river bends that I took when I was a grown-up and went on a pilgrimage to the place. I don't need it, because I can see it. I can feel it in my head at any given moment. It's a place of memory, but it represents, in a way, many other places. While writing this, I really spent a long time thinking about other places in my life that occupy a similar shelf in my memory. I didn't end up with a very long list at all. It seems natural to assume that such places are ones that we return to often, places and the emotions they bring forth in us that were given a chance to grow roots. I think I've moved around too much in my life to have a long list. But if I try to identify the specific emotion that the place where the river bends ignited in me, I find that other places, however fleeting, emerge. That spot on that island on the coast, another place where rock and trees meet water, where great birds of prey hunted salmon, where whales would surface, and that family of otters would swim past each and every afternoon. Then there is that mountaintop in the Alps, Pont de Nonto, a perfectly pointy mountain rising 2,170 meters into the sky. I was living in a ski town for a season, and one day, in the spring, I think this was back in 1992 or 1993, I looked up and said, "Hey, you know what? That looks climbable." Most of the snow had melted, so I spontaneously packed a lunch, and I left. I didn't tell anyone where I was going. I found a path up the mountain, but at some point I just headed straight up, embracing the thigh burn. It took a few hours. I didn't make it to the actual peak. The last narrow ridge had snow on it and looked quite treacherous. If I fell, I would have been quite dead. To the right, the mountain incline was steep and I would have rolled and tumbled for days. Somebody would have found my body at some point. To the left, it was a sharp, long drop to certain death, and I'm quite sure my body would never be found. No one even knew where I was. They wouldn't even dream of looking on the far side of that mountain. It was a sunny day. Mont Blanc raged up in the distance as I ate sandwiches in the wind before bounding back down the mountain like a giddy goat. So yeah, that was a one-hit wonder in this category, but you know what? It gives me all the same emotions as the place where the river bends. There are other places, but they are even more fleeting. Usually remote locations involving staring out at a sea or a landscape. Always alone. I've been sitting here for quite a while, thinking about other places. Continually analyzing that unique emotion I first experienced at the place where the river bends. Deconstructing it, sequencing it, in order to identify it. Searching the map in my head for other places in my life. I was searching for remote places until I realized, wait, you know what? This can also be urban. There's a cafe in Paris, Le Petit Fer à Cheval, where I have perched myself since the 90s. I simply can't go to Paris without having a coffee or a glass of wine there, watching the urban life pass on the narrow street in front of me, alone, but also with friends or lovers. Or the wine bar that I frequent here in Copenhagen, demonstratively sitting at a sidewalk table on one of the coolest streets in the city. These places are absolutely related genetically and emotionally to the place where the river bends. They fulfill the same purpose for me. The riverbank, however, enjoys a special place in my heart. The decades have served to elevate it to a mythical status. A place where a boy did some dreaming. A boy on the cusp of an adult life. A place of freedom and solitude. I just thought, hey, what if I never visited again, ever? The initial melancholy of that realization was quickly diluted by the knowledge that I probably don't need to. I've been there for the past couple of hours writing this. I can go there whenever I want without leaving home. Number 62, cold and sunny winter days. I've mentioned before that I love it when the temperature is warm. 30, 35 degrees is fine. 25, totally doable. I wouldn't miss cold winters if I never saw them again. Except for one kind of day. And again, I wonder how much influence the place we grow up in has on us, both the geography and the weather. Because where I grew up, on the prairies, near the Rockies, is an interesting weather pocket. It gets more hours of sunshine per year than Florida, even if it's 25 degrees below zero. So maybe as a result of living in freezing cold and blinding sunlight, I have reserved a special place for cold and sunny winter days. But then again, maybe it doesn't matter, because I know many people who love them as well. Maybe they're just all-round awesome days. Although, maybe even more so in a climate like Denmark, where winter is dull and gray, because those days, they literally brighten up your entire world. Today is one of those days here in Copenhagen. It's not that cold, only about 3 degrees, but the sun is bathing the city in light. I keep glancing out of the window at the buildings illuminated in winter sunshine. In midwinter 2021, during COVID lockdown, it got cold enough to freeze the lakes in Copenhagen. This used to be a normal occurrence every winter, but then hey, climate change is real. There was a period of more than a week with sunshine and below zero temperatures, and then, one magical day, the ice on the lakes was deemed thick enough to carry the weight of humans. It was an event, man. It was like the whole city was out there. I spent every day skating in wide looping circles, bathed in sunshine, but with my breath forming dreamy, ephemeral clouds in front of my face. It only lasted 3 days because it warmed up and the ice thinned. But it was magic. Every time it's magic. That sexy and sensual meteorological tango of bright light and biting cold. Number 63. Sailing. I was introduced to sailing as a young teen while spending summers on that West Coast island with my big sister and her husband, my brother-in-law. They had a small sailboat, 10 meters long. Just the basics, no bling, no gear. My brother-in-law taught me how to sail, and I was hooked. I'm on the fence between the classic existential feud between sailboat fans and motorized craft aficionados. Although I guess I lean towards the former. The simple beauty of reading and understanding nature and using it to propel yourself across the water instead of just hammering on through with a motor. My love of sailing, though, is a lot like my love of wine. I don't know most of the fancy terminology. I just know how to do it. I learned how to sail, not what all the bits and pieces are called. When I've been sailing later in life with other people, I'm a bit lost when I'm told to pull on the whatchamacallit or that thingamajig over there. I thought you said you could sail, Michael. Yeah, well, maybe terminology shouldn't be the primary indicator of anything. I love sitting out from the little harbor on that sailboat. Like the first lurch of a train leaving the station, the act of untying the last rope and stepping aboard, pushing off from the dock, signals a departure, an adventure, a journey. I had been handed the basics and had to figure out the rest, experimenting with the different sails in different conditions, learning how to most effectively tack back and forth up and down the strait. Not controlling nature, but learning how to work with it. I enjoyed the freedom of sailing, and sailing alone. It's like learning to ride a bike. You master a delicate machine, and you figure out all the moving parts. The sense of independence is extraordinary. A couple of times I was tested pretty severely. A storm rolled up the strait one day, out of the blue. A wall of fog tossed around on angry winds engulfed me. Visibility was only a few meters. I couldn't see the island, but I had to battle against the wind to try and get back to the harbor. I even had to tie myself to the mast with a rope. I couldn't see at all where I was, so I had to sail dangerously close to the rocky coast in order to see where the entrance to the harbor was. I remember the adrenaline rush, the thrill, and, yeah, the fear. A dream emerged in those teenage years on those coastal winds and waters. I was going to sail around the world on that boat. I would fit it out for an ocean-going voyage, and I would depart. A long list of exotic destinations appeared on a map in my head. Following in the footsteps of Paul Gauguin in French Polynesia seems to be the destination that has best survived the decades in my memory. But yeah, that didn't happen. I'm sitting here trying to figure out how I feel about that. It was a big dream in that young man. I feel a sense of, damn, didn't get to that one. But then, on the other hand, it doesn't seem like it's that crucial for me to get it done. It's a burning flame, but it's not that bright. I've mentioned before how I sailed from Fiji to New Zealand with a nudist German couple. A great experience, yeah, but like I said, it was a bit dull those 3 or so weeks on a placid ocean. I'm more of a landscape guy, or a coastal guy. The emptiness of the ocean doesn't stimulate me that much at all. But like so many things about making this podcast, I'm thinking about it now. I remember reading, I think it was in a book by the travel writer Paul Theroux, about this tribe of people who sell their homes and buy a sailboat and just spend their lives sailing in great looping circles around the world, following the seasons, summer in the Mediterranean, and then an exodus to the Caribbean, on to the Pacific, then continuing through South Asia until they return to the Med. And repeat. Man, that has an appeal. I wouldn't fancy doing that alone, though. It would be much more fun as a couple. Although when I have the declared goal of not owning anything, it kind of makes it tricky to plan buying a sailboat. The closest I've come was in the summer of 2020, when I bought an inflatable double kayak that I can slap onto one of my bikes, ride down to the harbor in Copenhagen, and paddle around in the sun. Not quite sailing, I know, but still, human-powered exploration of my city from the water. Despite the plastic and glue of the kayak, I can squint my inner eye and feel a connection with my ancestors in these waters, in this region. This is sailing country. Civilizations around the world figured out how to fashion sails out of papyrus or fabric and develop techniques that advanced the designs. In Scandinavia, boats designed for rivers and coastal sailing gradually evolved. The keel was invented in this region. Improved sails followed suit and eventually allowed the Norsemen to travel farther afield. The sight of 50 longships with brightly colored sails appearing on the horizon or around a bend in the river would have been as impressive as it was frightening for citizens all over Europe. That kid on his 10-meter sailboat in the West Coast waters, yeah, probably didn't frighten anyone. And this guy, now, in his green inflatable kayak in Copenhagen Harbor, doesn't strike fear into the hearts of anyone on land as I sail past. But you know what? I can dream. You've been listening to 100 Things I'll Miss When I'm Dead. I'm Michael Koble Anderson. Thanks for being out there.